Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You gotta hate it when the President of the United States goes out in public and says this.
Well, obviously, we can all imagine a scenario where we go off the fiscal cliff.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 14th of November. Good as always to have you with us. For the first time in a good long while, shall we say, the president took questions from reporters today, questions about generals and their emails, about Benghazi and about Syria, and about what happens if he and congressional Republicans just can't get their act together.
Middle-class families are all going to end up having a big tax hike.
Uh-huh.
And that's going to be a pretty rude shock.
Yes, it is.
For them, and I suspect will have a big impact on the holiday shopping season,
yep.
Which in turn will have an impact on business planning and hiring, and we can go back into a recession.
The president mentioned the holiday shopping season there. In point of fact, it's not even Thanksgiving yet, and we are already seeing companies blame the cliff for poor earnings results. The other thing, getting corporate blame and credit in some places, Sandy. Home Depot said the storm added $70 million in sales, but Saks Fifth Avenue, whose catalog, we should point out, does not offer a good selection of generators, says it lost sales in the Northeast due to the storm. It's always tempting for companies to blame things on the weather, you know, as they often do, whether it's legitimate or not. Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff sorts it all out.
It's an easy target.
You can't blame anyone else. Blame the weather.
Michelle Leader runs Footnoted.com. She says after Hurricane Katrina, all sorts of companies came out to claim it hurt earnings.
We saw that Intel mentioned Hurricane Katrina as impacting their business. Regis, the large haircutting chain, mentioned it.
Leader says Intel might have been a stretch. It's not easy to tell how much severe weather truly affects businesses. For many companies, storms just defer sales that would have happened anyway. You don't buy a sweater that week, but you do the week after. In general, weather isn't that big a deal in the scheme of things, says Matthew Cofina of Morningstar.
If you forego a week of sales, it's only 1/52nd of your year's worth of sales, and that's only 1 year in the very long history of a company.
But it's typical and tempting to blame the weather when there's another problem with your company. Stephen Bigger heads equity research at S&P Capital IQ, and he says you have to pay attention to see if there's something else going on.
It could be that a competitor has taken some share away. It could be that you don't have the styles that people wanted.
Even so, Bigger acknowledges Sandy was a big deal. But as more companies file earnings in the coming weeks, keep your eyes peeled. Michelle Leader says some filings will raise eyebrows.
There was a small company in China that I was looking at that said that they couldn't file their filings on time due to the storm.
Yeah, that doesn't sound right. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Back to the president now. Among the other questions that he got today was one about climate change and what he plans to do about it now that he's got a second term. He didn't really answer that part, but he did say this.
I am a firm believer that climate change is real, that it is impacted by human behavior and carbon emissions. And as a consequence, I think we've got an obligation to future generations to do something about it.
Along those lines, that is, doing something about it, there was a big auction here in California this afternoon. On offer were more than 60 million tons of carbon pollution, so to speak. The state actually auctioned off permits to sell carbon dioxide, rather auctioned off permits to emit carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And with that, California launched one of the biggest markets for pollution in the world. Eve Troeh has the primer now from the Sustainability Desk.
California's climate change law requires that companies reduce their pollution over time or pay the price. But that price had no actual dollar amount until today, says Ashley Lawson. She's a senior analyst at Point Carbon.
The purpose of the auction is to find what the market price is for one ton of CO2 emitted in California.
To give you an idea, one metric ton of CO2, carbon dioxide, is what's produced by an average month of electricity use in a U.S. home. The companies impacted by California's law emit at least 25,000 times that amount each year.
They think it will be cheaper for them to buy allowances from the state than to reduce their own emissions by adding some new technology or changing the way that their business runs.
But changing the way business operates is ultimately the goal of the climate change law. Dan Kamen teaches energy policy at UC Berkeley.
We've been living in a world where there is no price on pollution. It doesn't send the right signals. It doesn't reward innovators.
If state permits get pricey enough, it will be worth it for companies to invest in energy efficiency or switch to renewables, like solar. In the past, they'd pass that expense on to customers. But Kamen says, with a market for pollution in place,
it's not expected to show up very much in the economy.
Because the revenue from the auction, the money companies pay for the right to pollute, goes towards subsidies and programs that aim to make cleaner energy cheaper. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Ill winds were blowing on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The roadmap of the European debt crisis has pretty much gone like this so far. A country imposes austerity budgets, protesters protest, sometimes a lot, and then everybody moves on. Now, though, there are so many countries with austerity budgets, there's a whole lot of protesting, including today the first Europe-wide set of demonstrations that we have seen, which does raise anew questions about the future of the Eurozone, or if you put it another way,
what's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
So to get the answer for today, anyway, we go back to Miguel Ancho Morado. He's in Madrid. Miguel, hello again.
Hello.
So not to be blunt about it, but what's going on over there?
Well, we have a general strike, and not just in Spain, but also in neighboring Portugal and in several other countries in Europe. So you can call it the first global European general strike of the 21st century.
That's pretty grand. What's it like, though, for you as a regular person? Can you go out and get on a train? Is it hard to find a cab? Are stores closed? What?
Well, you of course, you are delayed. There are not so many trains, not so many buses. But in general, if you really want to go somewhere, you still can. What you see is lots of businesses closed. And then, of course, there are demonstrations. And it's pretty tense in that sense.
What about you? Are you surprised that this is happening sort of all over Europe?
Well, no, of course, I'm not surprised. The situation is very bad, so you have to expect protests. Now, the European aspect of it, I'm really a little bit skeptic, because there's really not Europe-wide politics so far. It's only for the leadership that Europe exists, but it's very difficult to get people to understand that we live in a community, in a European community, in which everything that is happens in one country affects everybody else. I'm afraid that in that respect, the European dream is not here, or maybe, if you are pessimistic, has failed. Because, no, I don't think there's a Europe-wide sort of political vision.
That's a really good point. There is a Europe-wide economy in a lot of ways, but there is no Europe-wide politics. So it's tricky to have a Europe-wide solution to this thing.
Absolutely. And in fact, that is what we would need now, because the problems are pan-European also, and the solutions should be pan-European as well. But organizing a worldwide strike sounds like the proper thing to do. But if it doesn't, it's not perceived as such by the governments, and I think they don't perceive it as a pan-European strike, but a series of national strikes, then it won't have much an effect, I'm afraid.
Hmm. Miguel Ancho Morado in Madrid today. All right, Miguel, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
The 112th Congress is in its final weeks, the lamest of lame ducks. And while it is too early to call the president the same thing, fact is, it's only a matter of time. There are no real term limits, though, in the business world, so a lame duck period is kind of a rare luxury. Top executives are often fired before they can even think about the end. Others, though, know when they'll go, either by choice or by mandatory retirement age. So Mark Garrison has this now from New York on the lessons lame duck CEOs might have to offer lame duck presidents.
A firm end date can actually be liberating. Columbia Business School professor Catherine Phillips focuses on leadership.
I think it kind of frees people up a little bit. They don't have to be so worried about ruffling feathers, I guess you could say.
Drawing a line in the sand on tax breaks for the wealthy is a reliable feather ruffler for conservatives. Here's the president on Friday.
I'm not going to ask students and seniors and middle-class families to pay down the entire deficit while people like me making over $250,000 aren't asked to pay a dime more in taxes. I'm not going to do that.
Lame ducks can be bold, at least early on. In the business world, it's rare for a CEO departure to be announced 4 years ahead.
Once the end date is known, it can cast a very, very long shadow.
Srivardhan Lele is a University of Maryland business professor. As the end draws near, it's harder for CEOs to make deals with friends, to say nothing of enemies.
When the other party knows that, well, we can wait it out, other parties now have an incentive to dig their heels in, to be less cooperative.
Second-term presidents worry about their historical legacy. CEOs tend to think shorter-term, as in boosting their final quarterly earnings. NYU management professor Joe McGee says history skips over most corporate leaders.
Maybe if you're the Fortune 10, Fortune 50 company that's really in the news a lot, maybe. But after that, people sort of forget these people. Well, we remember who the presidents are.
In early 2017, President Obama has to do something with the rest of his life. Will he campaign for global causes and Democrats like President Clinton, or lead a quieter life outside the spotlight like President George W. Bush? David Heenan is author of Leaving on Top, a book about exiting jobs. The end can be scary for CEOs.
A chunk of them treat retirement or moving on as something akin to either castration or euthanasia, and in fact have not planned the next season of life very well.
CEO or president, life after the big gig is a lot easier with a plan. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
It's no secret a lot of people are unhappy with the results of the election. And while we've all heard the old trope about people moving to Canada if they don't like who won, this next story takes that to a whole nother level. As of today, petitions have been filed from people in all 50 states looking to secede from the union. Some of those petitions have tens of thousands of signatures. So setting aside for just a minute, you know, reality, we wondered what secession might look like economically. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
What's so great about Uncle Sam anyway? He's always telling states what to do. He takes trillions of dollars in taxes away every year. What has he done for us lately?
Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamp benefits.
Economist Jared Bernstein says for most states, the value of those benefits outweighs what they hand over in taxes. But there are states that give more than they get, like New York and Colorado. Should they secede?
The answer is no, because we have such an interdependent system.
Think highways, disaster aid, the military. Expensive things for a would-be loner state. Wharton economist Kent Smetters says staying together is a better deal for all involved. Still,
one state could potentially pull it off.
That would be?
That would be Texas. Texas actually has its own electric grid. It's big enough that they could easily have their own money supply. They have a Gulf that they could ship from.
But what about Uncle Sam? Would his bottom line get a boost if he got rid of a nephew or two?
The state of Illinois is basically our Greece.
Smetters says Illinois' pension situation could require a federal bailout down the road. But today's basket case could be tomorrow's bread basket. Bread as in money, says Ernest Iztook, a fellow at the Heritage Foundation.
States that were prosperous at one time may not be as prosperous now. And the reverse is also true.
You never know where the next Silicon Valley or shale deposit might be. Better to keep the family together. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, you thought mass transit was the green solution? Freakonomics says nuh-uh.
The average bus carries only 10 people, and a bus burns an awful lot more fuel than a car.
But first, let's do the numbers. Kind of a mixed bag of worries today. The Dow Industrials have now erased all the gains it made since the start of the summer. The blue chips off 185 points, almost 1.5% today. Closing number, 12,570. The NASDAQ lopped off 37 points, more than 1.25%. 2846 was the final reading there. The S&P 500 dropped 19 points, more than 1.33%. That index came to rest at 1355. Financial shares were among the day's biggest losers. Bank of America stock withdrew more than 3.5%. Citigroup shares deducted more than 3% today. Abercrombie & Fitch, though, riding in style. Shares of the teen apparel chain jumped 34% on much better than expected earnings. 10-year treasuries pretty much held steady. The yield at 1.59%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Retailers find out how back-to-school sales went. We'll get profits from Sears, Walmart, and Wet Seal. We'll also get the latest reading on inflation. The Labor Department will release the Consumer Price Index for the month of October. And it's America Recycles Day, so don't forget to reduce and reuse. I'm Bridget Bodner. Oh yeah, and recycle!
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Let's bring the president back one more time, shall we, just to remind us of the theme of this Wednesday. What was it again? Oh, yeah.
Well, obviously, we can all imagine a scenario where we go off the fiscal cliff.
Nobody wants that to happen, right? But commentator Robert Reich says the president and Congress have to think carefully about how they plan to back us away from the edge.
We've got two big economic challenges ahead: getting the economy back on track and getting the budget deficit under control. The problem is the two require opposite strategies. We get the economy back on track by boosting demand through low taxes and continued government spending. We get the budget deficit under control by raising taxes and reducing government spending. But if we do too much deficit reduction too soon, we're in trouble. That's why the fiscal cliff is dangerous. The Congressional Budget Office and most independent economists say it will pull so much demand out of the economy that it'll push us back into recession. That's the austerity trap of low growth, high unemployment, and falling government revenues that Europe finds itself in. We don't want to go there. Although the U.S. economy is picking up and unemployment trending downward, we're still not out of the woods. So the government has to continue to spend, and the vast middle class has to keep spending as well, unimpeded by any tax increase. But waiting too long to reduce the deficit will also harm the economy, spooking creditors and causing interest rates to rise. It all boils down to timing and sequencing. First, we get the economy back on track, and then we tackle the budget deficit. This is why any grand bargain to avert the fiscal cliff should contain a trigger that begins serious spending cuts and tax increases only when the economy is strong enough. I'd make that trigger 2 consecutive quarters of 6% unemployment and 3% economic growth. To make sure this doesn't become a means of avoiding deficit reduction altogether, that trigger should be built into any grand bargain, irrevocable unless 2/3 of the House and Senate agree and the president signs on. The trigger would reassure creditors we're serious about getting our fiscal house in order, and it would allow us to achieve our two goals in the right sequence: getting the economy back on track and then getting the budget deficit under control. It's sensible and doable. But will Congress and the president do it?
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He writes books, too, most recently one called Beyond Outrage. Share your thoughts with us, Facebook, Twitter, regular, old email, whatever works. The list of things you can buy at Costco is long, big and long, you could say. 50 pounds of pretzels, a trampoline, batteries by the gross, basically anything. It's a list to which you can now add a house. The biggest of big box stores is offering home mortgages for its members, as Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
John Alexander is the director of the Costco Mortgage Services Program. He says describing Costco as a mortgage seller is a misnomer. The better term is mortgage marketer.
We literally market the services through Costco. So Costco is really the marketing arm.
Costco partnered with First Choice Loan Services and several other banks to offer mortgages to its members. According to Alexander, they serve 10,000 to 30,000 members a month. One of the benefits of getting your mortgage from Costco is that they vet the lenders for you.
I went out and selected the lenders to participate on the program. They guaranteed specific service levels, as well as competitive rates, as well as lower fees.
Those lower fees are great for consumers. And for Costco, it means more customers furnishing those homes. But Barry Zegas, Director of Housing Policy at Consumer Federation of America, says you should still shop around for the best deal.
The big advice I'd give to consumers shopping for a mortgage, regardless of where they're shopping, is to look for alternatives, you know, compare prices, and don't rush into it. Look for the best price. This is like any other consumer product.
And like any other consumer product, what happens if you get home and your mortgage just isn't working out for you? What's Costco's mortgage return policy?
Well, there's not necessarily a return policy once the loan is closed, but one of the things that they are guaranteed and assured is that there's a support line.
I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. That moment every couple of weeks, we talk to Stephen Dubner. He is the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. The Hidden Side of Everything is what it's all about. Dubner, how are you, man?
Doing well, Kai. Thanks. Here in New York, we are recovering still from Sandy.
Yes.
The transit system has mostly recovered. Our subways and buses...
Yep.
Getting back to moving about 7 million passengers a day, if you can believe it.
Honestly, it's amazing. And the fact that they pumped out all that water is kind of crazy.
It is. And, you know, we've been doing it for years and years. All that mass transit means that New Yorkers have one of the smallest per capita carbon footprints in the entire United States, because we all know that mass transit is very, very good for the environment, correct?
We do know that. And the only thing we don't know is where you're going, Dubner. That's the only thing I don't know.
Let's start by I'm going to introduce you to Eric Morris, who's
okay.
a regular contributor to Freakonomics.com, and he's a professor of urban planning at Clemson University.
All right,
mass transit can be an incredible boon for the environment. It can also not help the environment or maybe even hurt the environment.
Make up your mind, man. Come on.
How's that for clarity?
Yeah, right?
Okay. Let's say we're trying to figure out the energy efficiency of transporting one person, Kai Rizdahl, let's say,
yes.
in a car versus in a train or bus. Okay. Here's Morris again.
All right.
Obviously, the energy expenditure in moving around a transit vehicle per passenger mile depends on the number of passengers. Whether you have one passenger in a bus or 40 passengers in a bus, you're going to be expending almost the same amount of energy. So it all depends on the ridership and the occupancy that transit vehicles and, for that matter, autos carry.
All right. So what do we know about occupancy and ridership?
Eric Morris tells us the average American car carries 1.6 people. Not many, of course, especially if you're, you know, thinking about comparing it to mass transit.
Yes.
On the other hand, the average bus carries only 10 people, and
wow.
a bus burns an awful lot more fuel than a car, which led Morris to this rather surprising conclusion.
Typically, moving a passenger a mile by bus requires roughly 20% more energy than moving a passenger around by car. So just in terms of energy expenditure, bus actually fares worse than car.
That is crazy, man. And also, this is the point in the broadcast where we're going to start getting a lot of nasty letters, because people are going to go, wait, how can that be? I don't understand, right?
Don't worry. We're going to tick off other people in a moment, so don't worry about that.
But let me say this,
though. Trains are actually, on average, better than cars, more energy efficient per passenger, although that number is warped a little bit by one subway system, the New York City subway, which is just a monster of size and efficiency.
So let me just recap here, right, because this is a little twisted. If I take the bus in an average American city, I'm hurting the environment more than if I just drive myself to work, right? And the trains are better than that, but not by a whole lot.
Well, look, honestly, it's not so simple. It's very hard to come up with an answer to that specific question because of the trade-offs here. There's time trade-offs. You got to think about land use for parking, traffic fatalities that come with car travel that don't come with train travel. But Eric Morris's point is this. If you're thinking about carbon footprints for moving people around, we've all caught a bit of what you might call mass transit hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
We think that it's the solution, but it's not necessarily. It'll work great in a place like New York,
But in other areas, you know, we've picked a lot of the low-hanging fruit. You try to put a new train system in a smaller city where people don't have access to it, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Memphis, and those places, those train systems actually do worse than cars in terms of energy efficiency. Here's Eric Morris one more time.
In general, pumping up ridership by constructing new transit systems or adding new transit service has to be looked at very skeptically. On the other hand, if we can persuade more people to leave cars and move on to the existing transit service that we already have, that's a complete win for the environment.
Persuading people to leave their cars, though, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's like The Onion once put it, 98% of U.S. commuters favor public transportation for others.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, if you're this Clemson guy, Morris, how do you convince people to leave their cars?
Well, look, if you're a liberal and you hate the idea that we are sort of discouraging certain kinds of mass transit, here's an idea that you can hate if you're a conservative, okay? You get people to leave their cars by raising tolls on roads and taxes on gas and parking to incentivize more people to ride the transit systems that we've already spent billions on and are underused.
Hey, before we go, let me ask you, so what'd you do? Take a cab today, ride the train down to the studios, what?
None of the above. I'm in my office across the street from my apartment, so I hoofed it.
Nice.
Nobody else's carbon was killed in the making of this episode from my end, all right?
Stephen Dubner, freakonomics.com is a website. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Okay, Kai. Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a nod to my beer-loving brethren north of the border. You know the National Hockey League hasn't played a minute of its season yet, right? Big, nasty labor dispute going on. Down here, honestly, it's kind of second-tier news. Up in Canada, though, a big deal, a very, very big deal. So big, in fact, that the CEO of Molson Coors, the brewery, blames the NHL and the absence of beer-drinking opportunities like hockey games for soft sales up there, says he is going to ask the league to pay him back, to make good for it as well. So there you go. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow Industrial's off 185 points, 1.5%. The NASDAQ off 37 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500, Wyatt lost 19 points, about 1.33%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.